The New York Times best-selling Sisters of Suspense are back for one last breath. Lisa Jackson and Nancy Bush, two blockbuster authors who are also real-life sisters, join forces for one gripping novel of murder, greed, revenge, and the kind of family secrets that are worth killing for. Get ready for a fast-paced thrill ride that will keep you riveted to the very last page. One Last Breath by Lisa Jackson and Nancy Bush is on sale now everywhere books are sold. More info can be found at lisajackson.com. That's LISAJACKSON.com. Now, on to today's episode. If you lived in Princeton, Massachusetts in 2011, chances are you weren't accustomed to any sort of crime happening in your neighborhood, let alone a possible homicide.
So they lived in Princeton, which is just this beautiful town in the northern part of Worcester County. It's very rural, long, flat roads, kind of sprawling through these like great little neighborhoods full of trees and nature and everything like that. Quaint houses, a tiny, tiny little town common kind of an area. And it's not highly populated at all. You can see the mountains. I mean, it's just beautiful, but not somewhere where you expect someone to wind up dead.
Melissa Hansen is a reporter at Mass Live, where she covers breaking news, crime, and the courts. In December 2011, she covered a tragic and mysterious death that occurred on 20 Worcester Road in Princeton, Massachusetts. A prominent dentist's wife was found lying on the ground underneath a broken window of the home she shared with her husband. She was barely alive. What followed was a question of accident, suicide, or something more sinister that would pit members of the community and members of a family against each other. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 53. At about 2:45 a.m. on December 6th, 2011, a 911 call came into the Princeton Police Department. It was 69-year-old Dr. Roger Desolitz, who was calling to report that his wife had jumped out of their third-story window and was lying on the ground. He told the dispatcher that she was still breathing, but that he needed help. "She's mumbling. I can't understand a thing, but she's mumbling," he said. When first responders arrived at the home, about 5 minutes after receiving the 911 call, they found 65-year-old Kathleen Desolitz lying on her stomach on the grass, naked, and surrounded by shards of broken glass. A few coats had been placed on top of her, so only her head was visible. She was alive, but seemed to be having difficulty breathing. She couldn't move or speak. The third-story window directly above her had been broken. She was transported to the UMass Medical Center, but while she was in the ambulance, she stopped breathing. She was pronounced dead at 3:34 a.m. While Roger was at the hospital with his wife, he spoke with investigators about what had happened. He told them that he and Kathleen had been experiencing marital stress because of an affair he had been having. He said that because of the affair, Kathleen was jealous and insecure, and so they had started going to counseling to work on their marriage. As Roger was talking, the officers noticed that he had two blood marks on his face, one above his eye and one between his ear and cheek. When they asked about them, Roger told them that it must have been from Kathleen hitting him. He said he and Kathleen had gotten into an argument earlier that night. He had had her phone records pulled after she had insinuated that she had been having an affair too. Kathleen found those records in his briefcase, and their argument became physical. He said that Kathleen hit him, but that things eventually calmed down. They had sex, but then got into another argument after he said he made a sexually demeaning comment to her. He said Kathleen put on a robe and went upstairs. A little while later, he said he heard noises, so he went upstairs and saw Kathleen smashing the window with a chair. He said she then went through the window, either intentionally jumping out or due to the momentum caused by her swinging the chair. He ran over to the window, looked down, and called out her name. He then ran downstairs to check on her. He said he didn't try to move her, but he did take her pulse. He recalled telling her that she was going to be okay that she was strong, and then he covered her. Not knowing what else to do, he said he then called 911. He said Kathleen had no history of mental illness and that she was not intoxicated. He said she had never tried killing herself before and had never even threatened it before. As part of their investigation, police seized Roger's clothing and cell phone. They discovered that shortly after Kathleen died, around 4 a.m., Roger sent a text message to a friend of his, who was a trooper with the Sturbridge State Police Barracks. He asked the trooper to call him so they could talk about, quote, a disaster of unbelievable proportions. Kathleen's autopsy determined that her cause of death was blunt trauma of the torso with lacerations of the heart and fractures of the ribs and spine. The manner of death, however, was undetermined, and suspicion was raised after the coroner told investigators that she didn't believe that Kathleen's injuries could have just been caused by a fall. While rumors swirled around the affluent Princeton neighborhood, many neighbors and friends of the Desolates came to Roger's defense. Roger and Kathleen had been married for 44 years and had two grown daughters and six grandchildren. They had a summer home in Gloucester and a winter home in Florida. Roger himself was a prominent and well-liked oral surgeon, and people who knew the couple just couldn't believe that this was anything more than a terrible accident.
He was a very prominent dentist in the community. That seems kind of odd. You know, he wasn't like an athlete or anything, but for some reason, people just knew him as this talented, well-respected, and wealthy local dentist.
But on December 13th, 2013, about 2 years after she died, Roger was indicted by a grand jury and arrested on charges of manslaughter and assault and battery. His partners at the Central New England Endodontics issued a statement after his arrest, saying, quote, all of us who know Roger know he had no part in the tragic death of his wife. We have complete confidence in Roger's innocence and confidently expect that he will be exonerated. But surprisingly, members of Roger's and Kathleen's own family felt differently. An attorney representing the Desolates' two daughters, along with Kathleen's brother Bill, released a statement of their own, saying, quote, our mother and sister, Kathleen Desolates, died in a violent, brutal manner. Her death has left her family heartbroken. We are grateful for the efforts of the detectives and prosecutors who have worked so hard to seek justice for our mother and sister. Roger pleaded not guilty and was released on $5,000 bail, an amount that was agreed upon by both the prosecution and the defense. But before Roger would go to trial, Roger's defense team tried hard to get the case thrown out. The reasons for their motions to dismiss, the defense said, were threefold. They said the evidence was inadequate, what was presented to the grand jury was misleading, and the grand jury's decision to indict Roger was unlawful. They wrote that the grand jury was frankly presented with little more than the opinions of investigators and lay witnesses, that somehow Dr. Desolates was responsible for the death of his wife. They said the testimony presented to the grand jury was devoid of any evidence of criminal activity on the part of the defendant. They claimed that prosecutors relied upon a series of highly inflammatory statements in the form of personal opinions of civilian witnesses concerning their belief in the guilt of the defendant and their apparent belief that the alleged victim was incapable of committing suicide. Some of these civilian witnesses being Roger and Kathleen's two daughters. The prosecution countered that the grand jury heard ample evidence to support charges of either voluntary or involuntary manslaughter, as well as assault and battery. They asked that the motions to dismiss be denied. In addition to their motions being unsealed and now available to the public, so was the Bill of Particulars, which is a detailed, formal, written statement of charges by the prosecutor that is given upon the defendant's formal request to the court for more detailed information. In their bill of particulars, prosecutors wrote that Roger, quote, struck Kathleen Desolates and shoved her into a closed glass window, where she ejected through the glass window, hit the ground three stories below, and died. Outside the courtroom, Roger's attorney told reporters that if the judge denies their motions to dismiss, the case will never withstand a trial. But despite their claims, Judge Janet Kenton Walker denied their motions. The trial would go on. What was the atmosphere like in the courtroom going into trial?
There was a lot of positivity on Roger's side of the courtroom. He had three very high-profile lawyers defending him. It was a bit of a dream team, you know, and there was just a lot of confidence on that side of the room. And as even though they had such a big task of, like, making sure that he would be acquitted of this crime, you know, they didn't look worried or seem tense or anything like that. And it helps that Roger had support in the courtroom. You know, he had friends that were sitting on his side and, you know, took time out of their schedules to watch and defend him.
Opening statements began on January 17th, 2017, at the Worcester Superior Court. Assistant District Attorneys John Bradley Jr. and Christopher P. Hodgins were prosecuting the case against Roger, who was now 72 years old. Roger's attorneys were Louis Alois, a former homicide prosecutor, Michael Wilcox, and Ed Ryan. In their opening statements, prosecutor John Bradley told the jury that the night of Kathleen's death, a violent struggle had occurred between Roger and Kathleen. A struggle that occurred in the hallway area of the third floor and ended with Roger throwing Kathleen out of the window. He addressed Roger's behavior when officers responded to the scene, saying that he was calm, fully dressed, and had two visible cuts on his face and neck. Kathleen was lying on the ground on the side of the house. Her body was covered by a few coats, but underneath she was completely naked, Bradley said. He told the jury that Roger told the officers that he and Kathleen had had an argument and that she jumped out of the window. Bradley pointed at Roger, seated at the defense table, and said, quote, "We will prove to you, ladies and gentlemen, that that was a lie." He said Roger told multiple versions of what happened and recounted Roger's behavior after her death. Roger's family had trouble reaching him for days afterwards, and Roger didn't attend Kathleen's funeral. The two of them hadn't spent Thanksgiving together that year, and Kathleen and their daughters were planning on going to London for Christmas without Roger. On the night of her death, Bradley said a violent confrontation took place after Kathleen found out that Roger had hired a private investigator to pull her phone records. They argued over Roger's affair, and then he threw her out of the third floor window. The fall was a 30-foot fall, and Bradley said she had bruises and cuts all over her body that couldn't have just been caused by the fall. He also said that blood was found in the home that matched Roger and Kathleen. He said Roger struck Kathleen, causing an injury to her left eye and right side of her mouth. He pointed out that Roger gave different versions of what happened to different people, one time saying that he saw Kathleen swing the chair, and in another saying that he was downstairs when it happened. In their opening statements, Roger's attorney, Michael Wilcox, told the jury that Kathleen had taken her own life and had jumped out of the window. She decided she had had enough at that point. The government has to convince you of something that did not happen, he said. Wilcox told the jury that what the prosecution had left out of their opening statement was that Kathleen had violent tendencies and that she had physically attacked Roger three times during different incidents before the night she died. He said that could account for the blood in the house and the injuries on his face and neck. Wilcox said the evidence will show that Kathleen's DNA was on both sides of that third floor window, meaning that she had opened it prior to her fall. He said that another thing the prosecution didn't tell the jury was that scientific evidence shows that Kathleen didn't land on her stomach, but on her heels and buttocks. And although their marriage was on the rocks, Roger and Kathleen had had a nice day and night together on December 6th. They had spent the day in Boston, had dinner, then came home and had sex and drank some alcohol. But then, after Kathleen found her phone records in Roger's bag, she assaulted him before going upstairs. He said science would show that there was no other conclusion, that for reasons only she knows, Kathleen sat on the window after breaking the glass and either took her life or she fell. He also noted that Kathleen had taken Valium and had been drinking that night. As for Roger giving different versions of what happened, Wilcox said that he told investigators that his wife jumped out of the window and never strayed from that. He said by the end of the trial, scientific evidence would make it impossible for them to convict. After the opening statements, the jury went to the Deslett's home to see what the scene looked like. We'll get into the trial testimony and the evidence the prosecution will present right after this quick break from today's sponsor. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping, this 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City and Virginia Beach, or at any of the 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $125 off and a free pillow when you go to lisa.com/junkie. That's LEESA.com/junkie. I also wanted to take this opportunity to thank all of you who support this podcast on Patreon. Over the last month, more than 25 new Patreon supporters have signed up, and I could not be more grateful. It's because of you that Court Junkie is able to continue expanding and creating new content. I'm also pleased to announce that I have hired on a new legal researcher to help me acquire court documents, trial transcripts and audio, and file Freedom of Information Acts, so my research can be even more in-depth. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. If you would like to support this podcast, just go to courtjunkie.com/support, and that'll redirect you to my Patreon page. For as little as $1 a month, you can sign up and get early ad-free access to all Court Junkie episodes. There's also an exclusive RSS feed that you'll have access to that you can add to most podcast listening apps, including Apple Podcasts. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again. Now, back to the Roger Deslett's trial. On the first day of testimony, the prosecution brought in a rather surprising visual into the courtroom, the actual window from the Deslett's home.
I remember showing up before court convened one morning, and outside the courtroom is, you know, this window. I thought at first that it was a replica. I was just completely blown away when they were like, no, this is the exact window from the house, like down to every single last screw. And they, you know, used it from time to time during testimony, but even when they weren't actively using it as an example, it just kind of sat there in the courtroom, and it was very eerie in a sense to have the actual window in question sitting right there next to Roger. They actually had to really maneuver a lot to try and get it even, you know, past the seats in the courtroom and, you know, settled like next to where Roger was sitting and everything. They had to take the wheels off shortly for a second, if I remember correctly, and then screw them back on together. It was a whole big process just trying to get it into the courtroom. But yeah, it was kind of ominous just like sitting there in the corner waiting for them to wheel it out into view of the jury anytime that they wanted to make a point or demonstrate with it. And I've never seen, you know, a prop kind of like that used in a trial before. It was really something.
The prosecution's first witness was Travis Russell, one of the first police officers to respond to the Deslett's home that night. Officer Russell described Roger as being calm at first, but said that his demeanor changed when he was asked about the couple's argument that night. He said Roger told him that it had been about an affair, but then said that he didn't have to say what led to their argument. While the paramedics were tending to Kathleen, Officer Russell said he kept trying to ask Roger questions, but that Roger ignored him. The jury also heard the 911 call, where Roger tells the dispatcher that his wife jumped out of the window and that he couldn't get her up.
He was very calm during the call. His voice was steady. And as he described, you know, the fact that Kathleen was now outside and injured, it just didn't sound the way you might imagine someone would sound when they're calling 911 after their wife has had a crazy fall out of a window and is injured. You know, he mentions that she's mumbling and he can't understand her. And just as it's replayed in the courtroom, you hear how steady and calm his voice is. It's definitely not what a lot of people were expecting to hear during a 911 call in a moment that a lot of other people would be frantic.
One of Roger and Kathleen's daughters, Kara Burkhart, testified that she and her father had a wonderful relationship before her mother's death. She called him a devoted father who would go for walks with her and who went with her to her ultrasound during her first pregnancy. She said things got tense in their family about 4 months prior to her mom's death, after her mom found out about her dad's affair. She said her mom struggled with it, but ultimately decided to stay with him after he agreed to sign a postnuptial agreement. Her mom and dad argued a lot, and Kara said she felt like she was put into an awkward position. Her dad would call her and ask her to get involved, which stressed her out. And that's what she said happened on the night of Kathleen's death. Roger called her at some point in the evening and asked her to intervene in an argument they were having. Then, a little while later, she heard from her mom, who called to make sure that she was okay and wasn't too stressed out about it. They also made plans for the next day. She said her mom was going to come over to her house in Connecticut. When they were hanging up, her mom told her, "I'll see you tomorrow." And that phone call was the last time she ever spoke with her. Kara said she woke up to a call from her father later that night at 2:49 a.m. He told her that her mother had jumped out of their third floor window and wasn't breathing. Kara said she got into her car to go over to the hospital and called her older sister, Kristen, who lived in London. And Kristen was immediately suspicious.
There was one really emotional moment when Kara Burkhart was on the stand. She was talking through the step-by-step of everything that happened once she got that, you know, 3 a.m. phone call saying that her mother had gone out this window and was very badly injured. So she got into her car from her Connecticut home and started driving up toward the Worcester area, thinking she was either going to go to the hospital or, you know, do something. And she gets on the phone with her sister, who had to fly into Massachusetts from another part of the country. And she's talking about this phone call with her sister. And, you know, she says in her testimony, "My sister was the reason why I went to the Princeton residence. She said, there's no way mom jumped out the window." And I thought just that, like, clear kind of statement from her and the fact that she changed her whole course of action of what she was planning to do was just really powerful. The Desolate's daughters really felt like there was no way that their mother would ever be in the kind of mental state where she would project her body out through a window and down to her death. So Kara changed course. She didn't go to the hospital. She went up to the house to try and see what exactly happened there and then try and figure it out.
When Kara got to the Desolate's home, she said police officers held her back from the house and that she couldn't get a hold of her father, not that night, nor the next day. Then, 2 days later, she said her dad was in a mental health area at a Boston hospital, and he told her that he couldn't wait to sit down in front of a fireplace with his lawyers and tell them all what happened. But she said he refused to tell her anything about that night.
Another thing that really stood out to me was the fact that Kara said that Roger never told her what exactly happened that night. She kept repeatedly asking him, like, what happened to mom? And he would just say general statements like, you know, there was a terrible accident. But he never went through with her step by step what happened that night or gave her more information. about her mother's last moments alive. And that really stung her that she never got that clarification from him and never got to hear about what exactly happened from her father, who she trusted and who she had such a close bond with. And she just never got the answers that she so desperately wanted.
Kathleen's funeral was held a few days later, and she said her dad did not attend. Afterwards, he called her and gave her the number of an attorney. He told her to deny who she was to anyone who tried to serve her a summons, or anyone who would come up to her wearing professional attire. She said he told her that her mom would want them all to stick together, and that no one ever has to talk to the police. The last time she spoke to her dad was that month, in December 2011.
One moment from the trial that I still think of from time to time and really stood out to me was when Kara Burkhart, one of their daughters, took the stand. She was asked about her relationship with her father, and she went on to talk about how if her father had a favorite child, if he was asked, you know, which one really is your favorite, she said she absolutely would have been the favorite child. They had a really close bond and a special relationship. And you could just see the pain in her eyes and hear it in her voice, you know, and her having to describe how her and her father went from having such a close bond to not speaking anymore because of the question of whether or not he pushed her mother out of a window to her death.
On cross-examination, Roger's attorney brought up the fact that for years, Roger had been depositing money, more than $70,000 a year, into Kara's account. He noted that those payments had stopped in December 2011 and that Kara and her sister Kristen had filed legal papers in order to freeze certain assets. Kara said that was true and said that she and her sister wanted to protect their mother's assets from being given to their father. The prosecution's next witness was Kara's husband and Roger's son-in-law, Kurt. Kurt testified that Roger also called him that night and sounded upset and like he had been crying. Roger told him that he and Kathleen had been arguing and that she had threatened that she was going to jump out of the window. He said Roger told him that she then ran upstairs, and the next thing he heard was the thud of her hitting the ground outside. He said Roger sounded desperate and that he told Kurt that he didn't want to live without her and that he was considering killing himself. But by the end of the call, he said Roger was calm. Kurt told the jury that that was the last time he spoke to Roger, and that before that, he had a fantastic relationship with him. Kara's older sister, Kristen, took the stand too. She corroborated Kara's testimony that their family was incredibly close and added that her mother had been her best friend. As for her father, she was close to him too and said that she could count on him for anything. About the affair, she said that her dad told her that it had been an on-again and off-again relationship and that it had started 25 years ago, that he wasn't going to leave their mother. On the night of her mother's death, Kristen said she talked to Kara twice. She then called her father, who told her that her mom had jumped from the third-story window and that she, quote, didn't make it. Kristen said she didn't speak to him again until 2 days later, when she found out that he was seeking treatment at a mental health hospital. She admitted that her father looked devastated about what had happened, but said he wouldn't talk about it with her or her husband. After that, she said he never attempted to get into contact with her or her sister, and that they had to enlist the help of their family priest to get them cleared to see him in prison after their names were left off of the visitors list. Trooper Richard Fregan, one of Roger's friends, testified that Roger called him several hours after Kathleen's death. He said Roger told him that his wife had jumped from their third floor window while he was on the first floor, and he asked him what he should say to police. Kathleen's brother, Bill, testified that he didn't like the way Roger was acting after her death. He said Roger was very calm when he told him that Kathleen had died, and he said that the calmness bothered him. When Bill asked Roger what had happened, he said Roger told him that he would have to talk to his attorney. Bill said that he responded, "I've known you for 45 years. Why do I have to talk to your lawyer?"
So one big thing that the prosecution focused on was how many times Roger's story changed in the immediate hours right after Kathleen went out the window. You know, in the 911 call, he was saying that she jumped out, and then later the story changed to that she fell out, and they really just focused on the fact that, like, he was trying to hide something or cover something up there.
A friend of the Desolates couple, a woman named Marilyn Swift, testified that Roger gave her conflicting accounts of what had happened. She said that in the first version, Roger told her that he woke up to the sound of his wife hitting the ground, and that he then went upstairs and saw that she had gone through the window. But then, just a couple of minutes later, he said that he was upstairs with Kathleen and that she had jumped out of the window. Marilyn said that in the weeks after Kathleen's death, Roger would come into her church and that he asked her and her husband if Kathleen had ever said anything about being concerned that she had cancer and asked if they knew that she had seen numerous doctors because of that. Marilyn told the court that she told him she had no idea about any of that. A close family friend testified that Roger had told him that he was on the first floor of the house when Kathleen jumped. Another friend and neighbor of the Desolates, William Aubuchon, recalled asking Roger about the scratches on his face shortly after Kathleen's death. He said Roger told him that Kathleen had come at him with a knife. But then on cross-examination, William also told the jury about an argument he witnessed between Roger and Kathleen at a yacht club dinner in September, 3 months before her death. He said it got a little contentious and that Kathleen was cursing and Roger was trying to calm her down, but that he eventually got angry himself and they both left. Yet another family friend, Barbara Rome, said that she and her husband had gone to dinner with the Desolates the weekend prior to Kathleen's death and that Kathleen had been sad. And she said that a week prior to her death, Roger called her, crying, saying that he was afraid that Kathleen was going to have an affair. She said she reassured him and said that Kathleen hadn't been unfaithful, nor was she going to be. She described Roger as being absolutely possessive of Kathleen. She said she and Kathleen owned a consignment store together back in the 1990s, and that Roger would call the store 4 or 5 times a day just to talk to her. Then there was the more technical evidence that the prosecution presented. First, from the medical examiner, Dr. Kimberly Springer testified that Kathleen's cause of death was blunt force trauma to her torso, which had lacerated her heart and fractured her ribs and spine. She said Kathleen also had cuts on her upper back, a left eye injury, and contusions on her chest, arms, and legs. Autopsy photos were shown to the jury. Some of the photos showed bruising on Kathleen's arms and wrists, along with minor bruising on her lip, her left eye, and bruises on many other parts of her body, including on her buttocks. She also had bleeding under her scalp, which was evidence of blunt force trauma, and an incised wound on her back, which Dr. Springer said would be consistent with glass. But then the defense began their cross-examination of Dr. Springer. They pointed out that the dirt found on Kathleen's feet and buttocks was not tested to see if it matched the mulch on the ground directly below the window Kathleen had fallen from. They also pointed out a piece of evidence that Dr. Springer admitted she missed, a piece of mulch that had been found in Kathleen's hair. The defense was trying to say that although Kathleen had been found on the grass, she could have landed on a ring of mulch that had been much closer to the house. And if that were true, then it wouldn't necessarily fit with the prosecution's theory of Kathleen having been pushed or thrown out of the window. Dr. Springer agreed that she didn't find any grass stains on Kathleen's hands or on her elbows. She also conceded that Kathleen had likely landed on her butt and that her injuries were not consistent with what you might expect to see on someone who had been thrown through a closed glass window. There were no cuts on Kathleen's shoulders, arms, or torso. She said it was possible that the wounds on Kathleen's hands and wrists could have been caused by her grabbing broken glass from the bottom of the window, trying to break her fall. She also said that the cuts on Kathleen's back could have come from her sitting in the window after it had been smashed, and that her head wounds could have been caused from Kathleen possibly striking her head after landing on her buttocks. Dr. Springer also agreed that it was impossible to know for certain what the scrapes and bruising on Kathleen's body had really been from. She also confirmed that Kathleen had a blood alcohol content of 0.12, as well as had Valium in her system. The defense pointed out that people can make bad decisions when under the influence. Kristen Burke, a crime lab DNA analyst, testified about the blood evidence found inside the Desolates' home. She said Kathleen's DNA was found on a red-brown stain from the outside of the third-floor window, on red-brown stains inside the window frame, and on finger marks found on a piece of glass below the window. Kathleen's DNA also tested positive in red-brown stains found on the bathroom door, bathroom floor, and hallway wall of the third floor. Burke said Roger's DNA was found in red-brown stains on the trim of another third-floor bedroom, not the room from where Kathleen had fallen, as well as on the woodwork of the third-floor bathroom. On cross-examination, Burke said she could not determine how long the blood had been there. She was also asked whether a tipped-over chair that had been found next to the window had been tested for DNA, and she said no. That was the chair that the defense claims Kathleen had used to break the window. Colleen Tange, a trooper with the state police's crime scene services, testified about what the home looked like when she arrived to videotape the scene. The jury was shown a 40-minute video of the inside and outside of the Desolates' home. They also heard a voicemail that Kathleen had left on Roger's phone at 8:31 p.m. the night she died. The voicemail said, quote, "Roger, I'm going to Kara's tonight, so I hope you get this message. If not, you know, tough luck. Just leave." The prosecution also presented evidence that showed that shortly after that voicemail was left, Roger received another call from his home, and a minute and a half long conversation took place. A former office manager for Roger's practice testified that in November, just 1 month prior to her death, Roger had asked her to pull his wife's phone records for him. He told her that someone was making harassing phone calls to Kathleen and that he needed to find out who it was. He told her not to tell Kathleen because he didn't want to upset her. Lieutenant Robin Fabry, the crime scene supervisor, testified that shards of glass were found about 12 feet from the side of the house and within a radius of 19 feet. The majority of the glass, he said, however, was in close proximity to the home. On cross-examination, Fabry said that he did not see any red-brown stains on the floor of the bedroom, on the bed sheets, on cushions that were on the floor, on the pillows, on a robe that was on the bed, on the chair by the window, or on the curtains. He also said that the curtains did not appear to have been pulled on or stretched, and that the curtain rods were intact. In other words, he didn't see any signs of a struggle in the bedroom. Roger's taped interview with police, which was conducted at about 4:30 a.m. at the hospital, was also played in court. Officers read him his Miranda rights, and Roger questioned whether he needed a lawyer in order to speak with them. But then he said, "I don't feel like I need a lawyer. I'm trusting you guys." Roger then told them that he and Kathleen had a good day. They had traveled to Boston and then ate dinner at their home. He said that although their marriage had been strained after his affair, things were getting better, although he had concerns that Kathleen would cheat on him. He told the officers that after Kathleen discovered her phone records in his bag, she took a swing at him. He said she hit him above his right eye with her hand and then tried to kick him. Things calmed down and they had Bailey's Irish Cream and a few Valium pills, although he said neither he nor Kathleen were intoxicated. He said the two of them had sex and then afterwards he made a joke that she took badly. She got upset and went upstairs to the third floor. He said he told himself that he would go up in about 5 or 10 minutes and everything would be okay. But then he heard a noise, and when he got to the upstairs hallway, he saw Kathleen swinging a chair at the bedroom window. He said, quote, "As I ran towards the door, I thought there's no way she could break through that glass with that chair. The next thing I saw, the glass broke, and she went right after it." He said he didn't know whether she had intended to jump out of the window or whether the momentum had carried her through. He was adamant that he did nothing to harm her and added that she had definitely been hurt and suffering, but that she had never been diagnosed with any sort of mental illness. After almost an hour had passed, Roger told them that he couldn't talk about it anymore. He said, quote, "I think you guys mean well, but I also think there's a little insensitivity as to what I've been through tonight. I feel that I'm dying right now." One of the officers who was in that interview with Roger testified that Roger extended both arms in the air and described Kathleen falling as like a swan dive. He said later that day he went back to the Desolates' home to talk to Roger again, and Roger asked him if he thought that Kathleen may have tripped and fallen out of the window. When it was the defense's turn to present their case, they called Dr. Elizabeth LaPosada to the stand. Dr. LaPosada was a private forensic pathologist who reviewed the case for the defense. She told the jury that Kathleen's body did not go through the closed window and break the glass, as the prosecution was claiming. She said she studied the autopsy report, toxicology report, photographs from the autopsy, and visited the scene. She concluded that dirt found on Kathleen's heels of her feet, hands, and buttocks showed that she had landed in the mulch area directly below the window. She said that there was no evidence that Kathleen had landed on the grass. She said that based on her injuries, Kathleen was able to move from her initial landing spot. When asked if it was possible that Kathleen had broken the window, pulled glass from the bottom of it in order to sit, and then had either jumped or fell, she said yes, and that the cuts on Kathleen's hands were consistent with picking glass out and cutting herself. She noted that there were also injuries on Kathleen's upper left thigh that were consistent with sitting on a window frame. Carson Aubuchon, wife of the prosecution's witness, William Aubuchon, and longtime friend of the Desolates, testified for the defense. She said that one morning near the end of August, she went over to the Desolates' home. She described Kathleen as being extremely agitated, crying, loud, and pacing. She said Roger was standing at the kitchen sink while Kathleen paced around the room. She then testified that she saw Kathleen hit Roger in the chest and kick him. In his closing argument, Assistant District Attorney John Bradley Jr. didn't hold back about the defense's theory in the case. He called it absurd and one by one went through the testimony the jury heard in the case. He said Roger's own daughters testified that their mother would never harm herself and would never jump from a window naked. He also pointed to Roger's actions afterwards, calling him so all over the board, it's ridiculous. The prosecution had constructed a whiteboard that showed all of the various statements Roger had made to various people, and it was displayed as Bradley spoke. He said the blood evidence shows that there was a violent struggle in the hallway. The bruises on Kathleen's arms show that she was dragged into the bedroom. He said Kathleen was too small to break the window, but that Roger was the one who did it. The cuts on Kathleen's back, he said, were from self-defense, not from her sitting in the window as the defense had claimed. Bradley said the blood stain that was found on the exterior of the window was part of their struggle. He said Kathleen was doing whatever she could to try to save herself, but Roger pushed her out backward and then left her there for as long as an hour before calling 911. He said Roger's phone records show that at 1:40 a.m., about an hour before he called 911, Roger called his private investigator. When he wasn't able to get through, he made two other calls, one to his house phone and another to Kathleen's cell phone. In his interview with police, Bradley said Roger doesn't mention these calls. For whatever reason, he's trying to locate all the phones in the house, he said. Why? Because Kathy had already gone out the window. Bradley also pointed out that Roger was fully clothed when help arrived, including having a belt on. He said that it would have been impossible for him to have done that in the 2 to 4 minutes after having called 911. Don't you think he would have been outside in his boxer shorts, not leaving his wife's side, as his wife was literally dying on the grass? Bradley asked. He said Kathleen was moving on from the marriage and that Roger couldn't deal with it, which is why he had asked a private investigator, as well as his office manager, to probe her phone records. He said, quote, "The believable evidence in this case has shown that the defendant, Roger Desolates, broke the heart of his wife Kathleen twice. He broke her heart first figuratively in August of 2011, when she found out about his long-term infidelity. And then he broke her heart literally in December 2011, when he forced her out of that window and she plunged to her death, tearing her heart open and causing her to bleed to death internally." In their closing arguments, Michael Wilcox reiterated that evidence proved that Kathleen was intoxicated and angry at her husband. So she shattered the window with a chair, sat on the windowsill, and either jumped or fell to her death. He said the prosecution is aware of the problems with their case and that they had misinterpreted forensic evidence. The fact that Kathleen's DNA was on both sides of the window proved that she removed pieces of glass from the window and then sat down. As the judge was preparing the jury instructions, the prosecution objected to certain wording. There was a part in the instructions about Roger having pushed Kathleen into a closed window, something that the prosecution had initially claimed in their bill of particulars. But as you'll recall, during the trial, the prosecution's own expert, medical examiner Dr. Kimberly Springer, conceded on cross-examination that she would expect more injuries on Kathleen had she gone through a closed window. But since this was a part of their initial allegation, Judge Kenton Walker decided to leave it in the instructions. So as a result, the jury would have to consider whether Roger had struck Kathleen and then shoved her into a closed glass window. In addition to the manslaughter charge, the jury also had to decide whether Roger and Kathleen had struggled in the hallway beforehand for that assault and battery charge. The jury of 6 men and 6 women deliberated and found Roger Desolitz not guilty of all charges.
I think the district attorney was shocked. I mean, I saw his face as people left the courtroom after the acquittal, and he just looked completely surprised that Roger was found not guilty. You know, I think they were just feeling like, you know, what else can we do with this case? You know, there was no other suspects or anything like that. On the other side, Roger just had a look of complete relief on his face. He started to tear up a little bit at certain times. And, you know, some of the friends that had been sitting there, you know, came outside and they were like, well, of course he's not guilty. He would never do something like that. He was one of the most loving men that we ever knew, someone who cared so much about his patients and about Kathleen. So, you know, of course he's not guilty. He would never push her out of a window. His lawyers declined to say too much right away after the verdict, but, you know, they were hugging him and they were saying that it was a fair and just decision by the jury. You know, they were just really happy to see freedom for their client who's able to just walk right out of the courthouse that day.
Kathleen's family, however, was not happy. They released a statement to reporters that said that they could not be more disappointed with the verdict.
They said, quote, while we respect the legal process, it remains clear to us that only one person could be responsible for the death of Kathleen Desolitz, Roger Desolitz Jr. They went on to describe Kathleen as kind, thoughtful, and warm-hearted, and said that, you know, even all these years later, her death remains a heartbreaking loss and they miss her every single day.
Less than 24 hours after his acquittal, Roger sat down with a local reporter for an exclusive interview. He said he never harmed his wife, that he misses her, and that she was with him in court on his side. And that's all for this episode. I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you think Roger Desolitz is guilty of murdering Kathleen? What do you think about the prosecution's case? How would you have voted if you had been a juror? Let me know by joining our Facebook discussion group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook. Tweet me at courtjunkiepod or email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. A special thank you to Melissa Hansen for helping me out with this case. And as a reminder, if you want to hear these episodes without the ads and earlier than everyone else, just go to courtjunkie.com/support. This will redirect you to my Patreon page where you can sign up to donate as little as $1 a month. You can then either listen to the early ad-free episodes online or on the Patreon app, or you'll have access to an exclusive RSS feed that will let you listen on many of your favorite listening apps, like Apple Podcasts. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.